Welcome to the Permatemp Corporation. A presentation of the audio podcast, This Is Actually Happening. Episode 32. What if you lived through the Sri Lankan Civil War?
When I was 5 years old, we moved to Nigeria. We stayed there for 5 years, and then we moved back in 1983. I was 10 years old when I came back. 1983 probably wasn't the best of years to come back to Sri Lanka. That's when the 13 soldiers being killed, and then the riots that followed that. To middle class, it was to us, like us, it was like a big shock to the system. What the hell just happened? To me, this war started, everyone loves to blame the British for everything that happens along the world, so let's start there. The British came and they needed to rule the country, you know, it's a divide and conquer policy. They installed all the Tamils in the British civil service. You get the British and then you get a layer of mostly Tamil civil service. It becomes a class division. The gentry is mostly Tamil and the people of the country are mostly Sinhalese. The Tamils come mainly from the southern part of India, and apparently us Sinhalese come from the northern part of India. There's a matter of religion. There's like the Sinhalese are predominantly Buddhist, the Tamils are predominantly Hindu. So the north of Sri Lanka is predominantly Tamil, and then south is predominantly Sinhalese, and then we live in the south, and you know everyone feels boxed in. The Tamils say we are the minority in this country. The Sinhalese say, no, we are the minority in this world. The Sinhalese always feel threatened by the fact that this is the only place that the Sinhalese live. Tamil Nadu, India is a huge country right next door, and it's all Tamil, so it's Tamil Nadu. So and Jaffna is really close to Tamil Nadu, and you know there's a lot of trade and a lot of interaction there. And, of course, there are two different languages, which is a huge, huge problem. Because, to be honest, these two people cannot communicate to each other. When the British were in occupation, as it were, the modus of government operation was English. And it continued to be so. Until the British had already left, we've had the first Prime Minister that came in, that he came in on this kind of racial ticket. He came in on a popular ballot to change this system. He ran on a vote of the popular mass of the Sinhalese people saying, you're being oppressed by the minority Tamils. And he installed Sinhala as the predominant language of Sri Lanka, which meant that, you know, that the bulk of the country could now, the government institutions and were accessible to them, right? But at the same time, it meant that suddenly, say a telegraph that's sent to Jaffna, right? Earlier would be sent in English. The telegraph would be then taken to the headmaster of the school, who would translate it from English into Tamil to tell the person. But suddenly the telegraph goes to Jaffna and there's no one in Jaffna who can understand Sinhalese. Suddenly we isolated the Tamils. You know, suddenly the floor was taken up away from under them. You know, it was just, you know, it's division by language. Political parties built on any racial lines are always unfortunate. People can say, to get into power, they can say wonderful things. You know, in one sense, it's a failure of democracy. When you push people to a point that they have nothing to lose, you know, then, you know, that is basically what happened with the liberation tigers of Tamil Eelam. The Sinhalese will tell you this all happened when 13 soldiers were killed by the LTTE, the Liberation Tigers of Tamil Eelam. Eelam being, it's another word for Sri Lanka really, but it's a part of the country that the LTTE wanted, the top part of the country. It was not as highly organized force or anything at the time, but they were heroes because obviously the Tamils felt oppressed by the Sri Lankan Sinhalese army. And with that oppression going on, obviously that, you know, they now the Sinhalese see it as 13 soldiers were killed by the LTT, and that was a big slap in the face. That was to the Sinhalese, yes, that was a major, and that is what sparked off the riots. It's like, if we can't live in, if we can't, you know, if our boys are getting killed in, you know, in the north, then Tamils can't live in Colombo. This swarm of people would, I remember they came to our house, and, you know, Sinhalese people, they would like basically loot, pillage, burn down houses and like business establishments of Tamil people. The accountant who used to run my father's business before my father, he came and stayed with us. So then that meant that there was something wrong for me. To see his whole family coming and live with us, it was like, what was going on? So that is actually my start of knowing that something was going wrong at 10 years old, was when my father's accountant came and started living with us. Whereas the father, Mr. Kanusabi, and the mother were very calm and collected and, okay, there's some stuff going on. The son was very agitated and very, like, you know, and he was, like, regarding the Sinhala people in filth and, you know, this kind of thing. And, you know, to me at that time, it was very insulting. You know, you think, hey, you're living in my house. You know, I'm sure his cousins or his, like, were being attacked or, like, their houses were being burnt, but you don't realize that. I do remember then the swarm of people coming. They came to, the mob came to our house and asked us, are you Tamil? And you go, no. And that's it. But, you know, they said, yeah, there's no one here that's Tamil. Let's, you know, just kindly move along. I remember they were in the back of the, they were in the kitchen area. Obviously, the gate is in front, the kitchen is at the back. They weren't, like, cowering away. I remember I was with them, and, you know, it's not to say that my parents were heroes for doing that. It's just, you know. That was July, and that's, I remember that because that's when my brother was born, and this whole month of, like, you know, I remember, so the riots happened, my father went through, you know, the riots and took my mother to hospital. My father actually drove through the riots and for my brother to take him to hospital in the middle of this riot. Quite a drive between, like, burning shops and people on the road and, you know, mobs and, you know, people being attacked, or, you know, just like mayhem. To us, we live in this wonderful country. When this happens, it shakes your belief in the country, in the systems of your core beliefs is shaken, because you think you live in a wonderful country, but this can happen at any, you know. It was a shock to the entire system. Yeah, we are a middle-class family, and, you know, it is an economic, I mean, obviously, these people on the road, obviously not, you know, they were not rich people, or they were not, like, from any kind of education, or they were just, like, felt disenfranchised. We were not prepared, maybe, you know, in a way, like, look, if you look at the London riots, they were not prepared for that. Of course, it's always a matter of highs and lows. So, say, after 83... for, like, say, 5 years or so, it wasn't really affecting us badly. There's a war going on in the north, which doesn't really affect us. But eventually what happened was civilians were being attacked. And that is when horror sets in, or terror. So the initial stages of it is it's a very unorganized kind of thing, where they, like, you know, pistol groups, they'd, like, shoot someone in Jaffna with a pistol, or, you know, assassinate people, or, like, public figure, you know, people like that, and people in positions of power. Or, but then the terror sets in when it's tit for tat. So, like, there was some kind of oppression, the 13 soldiers get in, there's a riot, you know, it's all an excuse for the next step and the next step of violence. There's pistol groups, and then the army sort of invades and, like, you know, tries to, like, you get this kind of occupation, and then it progressed from being just the politically, or the army being attacked, or the police being attacked, into civilians being attacked. You'd get situations where buses were stopped and people were slaughtered. You know, a group of the LTT came in and they just shot everyone down, mowed everyone down with, like, automatic gunfire. Started with that, and then they progressed into bombs, which are, of course, a simpler and much more effective way of, where you would have a bus would be blown up. So Initially, there were like targets like the central bank, which, you know, where they take a truck into a crowded building and blow it up. It's this thing of terror of you not knowing whether you leave the house. Statistically, you're going to survive this, because if you take the amount of, you know, how many people live in this country and how many people die, it's not going to affect you. But the terror of like not knowing. I mean, I remember we'd have house parties, but we couldn't really go out and do stuff because, one, there's always this guilt because, oh, there are these people dying on your behalf, if you like. And, you know, that's always with you, that there are people, like, this isn't people dying, they're dying, like, you know, 200, 300 kilometers away from you on your behalf, if you like, you know, to make sure that Colombo stays safe. And so you feel really guilty to go out and party. I remember the papers always, like, this many people, of it's like a body count of a body count of like this many army people, this many LTT people, and it's always like there was a lot of repression of that kind of like part of our life as teenagers, because we would not, you know, having seen that, we can't, you know, meeting up and having, you know, conversation like we do, going to cafes and hanging out and stuff, that because, you know, your parents are scared what time you'll get home, you know. And you're guilty about having a good time also, which is, you know, this is mainly that's a huge guilt that is, you know, on you. And of course, the other thing is the absolute terror of, I mean, it drains you. The terror drains you of not knowing when the next bomb goes off or where it'll be. So you're always, like, you know, you're always on edge. When someone gets into a bus with a bag, you're looking at the guy, you know, you're always on edge. There were suicide bombings, yes, and of course then later on it progressed from suicide bombings to these claymore mines, which are like where they rig up mines, they rig up bombs on the side of the road and they'll be remote triggered. So they weren't even suicide, they like someone would with a, like a very simple remote control device, say tie a bomb onto a claymore mine onto a tree, and as a bus passed, blow up the mine. I mean, it became easier to do that, and, you know, why waste a suicide card when you could just blow up a bus with a claymore with a remote control? Then there was this attack on a clothes store where they just left a bomb inside the parcel counter and blew it up from the other side of the road. Blew it up as a bus passed again, so to get maximum kind of impact. I went to England in 1990, 3 years. I came back in 93. So I went to university in England and I came back in 93. I started working after that. So to me, Sri Lanka was a great country and, you know, I loved living here, whatever the... So yes, in England you didn't have the war, but racism, I mean, I just found that racism exists everywhere. And it's like, you know, it was interesting to, you know, be targeted by skinheads or like people like calling you black or like assuming that, you know, talking to you funny because they think you can't understand English. And then you take a turn and suddenly there's a bunch of skinheads and you're like, you know, do you walk past very calmly or do you turn and run the hell away? You know, that was prevalent. I mean, I lived in Manchester, which was a party town, yes, but... the moment you step away from the safety of the university, of these liberal-minded people, then you're in the the outskirts of Manchester. It's, again, it's economic. It's all economic. I used to cycle into university and, you know, like sticks are thrown at you, you know, it's harassment. I remember the easiest thing for me to do was I put on gloves and I put on a helmet, like I put in a motorcycle helmet so that people don't see whether you're black or white. It was the simplest thing to do. So I just cycled into university. I mean, you're like kitted up completely from head to toe. I remember once I was like, look, I'm a foreign student. I'm like, I'm leaving. I'm not staying here. But they don't care. You think it's because like these people, like the Indians come in and take the jobs and whatnot of you know, these disenfranchised white people there. They're angry with you. It's not that. So I tried to explain once, look, I'm a foreign student. I don't think they even understood the relevance of that or what I was saying, or like it's just like, oh, you know, you know. And, you know, I suppose nothing really bad happened to me. So, you know, you get into fights and stuff. And it's, again, all about people using race as excuses for what is really wrong, which is that you don't have an education, or you don't have, like, you know, you want something, you blame it very easily on, not on yourself, but on, you know, it was like some of it, you know, it's just that me, I don't have this kind of victim kind of thing, and I don't appreciate it. So I was just more comfortable here than I was in England. I mean, one factor was the cold, which I just could not take. The miserable weather, it just, you know, I just couldn't fathom, you know, I couldn't just understand, or like, why people don't, like, you know, live here at all. I did come back in the midst of a war, yes, I did. But, you know, you are so conditioned to bombs going off that in a week you kind of, I mean, you're afraid, but it's not like business, for example, thrived in this country, even during the war. It's that we are very resilient in that sense. It's like, you know, the war was going on, but not a single fuck was given. You know, it's like, okay, you know, it's like, but we will go on. We will, like, you know, we will carry on. That kind of attitude was always there. And that is, you know, okay, we're scared, and we don't, like, you know, like say, don't party, you don't go out. You think of, every time you go out, you think of your route and how quickly you can get back home, right? At the same time, you know, it's like, I had children, and I was taking them to school during the war. You know, you fear whether your kids will, you know, you try not to send them in the bus, you take them to school yourself, because you think, at least if the bomb goes up, you'll, like, die together, kind of thing. It's called thick skin, I suppose, in a way. You quickly, like, a tragedy happens, and, like, so 23 people die in a bus, but beyond that, it's quickly, like, put aside and, like, you know, compartmentalized, and, like, it's not sorrow and grief. It's like, because you're so it happens so often that you're so conditioned to it. And then the way you cope with it is you put it out of your head. You're careful and you're scared, but you put it out of your head, and you're like, you know, you stand up and you carry on. You know, you can find excuses, a lot of excuses, not doing stuff. But I had so many people asking me to do stuff that I started a business, because, you know, that's just the demand and supply thing. It's has very little to do with the war. Some people ask me, when I invest now, like, I'm successful, when I invest, why would you invest so much in Sri Lanka? Or why, you know, are you comfortable? And it's like, I always say, it's because I have the work. People are asking me to do stuff. And in a way, the people who invested during the war, are you know, business is about risk. And if you're scared about taking risk, obviously you don't succeed. So many people are scared of investing in Sri Lanka. The people who do make money. But when I say invest in this country, I don't mean just put money down. I mean invest their time and effort. They prefer to, like, say, emigrate and go somewhere else where it's just simpler, the rules are there, you know. But when you do, the rewards are great. I mean, you've got to have kids, you've got to work, you've got to, you know, do your stuff. You've got to do your stuff. But it's how you do your stuff. You just become smart. It's about statistics. It's about, if you spend less time on the road, it's less likely that you'll get, like, caught to a bomb. I came when I was 10, and then it ended when I'm, like, 37, 38. So by that time, like I said, I have children, I have a business, I have children. Of course, once a war ended, it's like, it's an amazing sense of relief, and, like, you know, it's over, and we can now do stuff that, you know, I mean, most of us are now reliving bits of our youth that we couldn't live out before. I mean, being a little bit immature in things that we do, like trying to party when you're 40 years old into the middle of the night and do stuff like that we couldn't do as teenagers. But, you know, you go to clubs and they're like 40-year-olds, like, gyrating, because they couldn't do this when they were, like, you know. Sri Lankans think of themselves as very modern and very, like, very first world people. At the same time, they had to go through this horrendous war at their doorstep, you know. It's a very diverse country. At one end, you're living this very Western lifestyle. And the other end, you get this, like, very machete-wielding, like, you know, AK-47 war. You know, it's diversity again. But we're just glad that it's over and done with, and now we can get on with... I'm not talking about building nations. I'm just get on with life, you know.